Welcome to Health Hats, learning on the journey towards best health. I'm Danny Van Leeuwen, a two-legged, cisgender, old white man of privilege living in a food oasis who can afford many hats and knows a little bit about a lot of healthcare and a lot about very little. Most people wear hats one at a time, but I wear them all at once. We will listen and learn about what it takes to adjust to life's realities in the awesome circus of healthcare. Let's make some sense of all of this. Nothing about me without me. Although she wasn't the first, I heard it first from my friend and fellow podcaster, Casey Quinlan. Actually, Valerie Billingham said it in 1998 at the Salzburg Global Summit. I first met Ellen Schultz in 2017 at a CMS, that's the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, technical expert panel, also called a TEP, T-E-P, on quality measurement. I heard her say, "Nothing about me or for me without me." I'm sure she wasn't the first to say that either. I don't know who was. After we met, Ellen and I organized to push the TEP to advocate for patient engagement and quality measurement. Success! A recommendation became: patients and caregivers need to be engaged in all aspects of measure development from priority setting to reevaluation. You can see the CMS definition of quality measures in the show notes. I like that Ellen talked about the practicalities of the slogan of patient engagement. It's more than words. How can we engage patients in measurements? Since we met a few years ago, we continued to cross paths and share ideas. Ellen Schultz is a senior researcher at American Institutes for Research, AIR. Her work focuses on the intersection of healthcare quality measurement and patient and family engagement. Ellen finds that blending science and passion has an enormous potential to change the world for better. I'm delighted Ellen could join us. Ellen, thanks for joining me. This is wonderful.
Great to be here, Danny. Always nice to talk with you.
It really is. I was trying to remember. We met at a CMS, Center for Medicaid Services, technical expert panel on measurement, right?
Yes, it was something about more efficient measurement or the future of measurement, some long convoluted government.
Yeah, it wasn't about measures in particular. It was more the development of measures and the system for development of measures. And I think I the first time I heard you talk, I'm looking over at the table and I'm thinking, okay, I got to know this woman. There was you were very strong on patient engagement.
Yes, that, and you know, it's interesting. That was a couple years ago now. I was probably only about a year and a half or 2 years into my work around patient and family engagement. Previously, I had done a lot of work around measurement. That's how I ended up on that panel. But like so many measure developers, no thought whatsoever to what the role of patients or family members or community input might be. And then I came to AIR, the American Institutes for Research, where so many of my colleagues had been deeply involved in patient and family engagement for quite a while. And I felt like, here's something that really makes a lot of sense. Okay. I used to introduce myself and tell people, I do a lot of work on measurement, but it's not really what gets me out of bed in the morning. And then I felt like those two pieces came together and I found a space where I could have both passion mm-hmm. and, you know, bring some of that technical expertise around measurement. And I thought, this I'll get out of bed in the morning for.
So Ellen, measurement of what?
So that's a really good question. And I think often we don't ask that question. We just dive right into measurement. It's sort of a foregone conclusion that we need to measure things. And recently I've been thinking a lot about some of the biases or mental models that we have in healthcare, like so much of today's world, that really pushes towards the quantitative and devalues or ignores qualitative, narrative, story-based ways of knowing.
So quantitative is numbers and qualitative is more stories.
Stories or okay. words, yes. And, you know, in healthcare, there's been an adage for a long time, my whole career now going on 15 years, that you can't improve what you don't measure, right? And that was really the argument for why we need measurement of everything, patient safety, of the quality of care. We need to measure outcomes. We need to measure processes. We need checklists, lots and lots and lots of counting. And look at where we are. We have thousands of measures. We have millions and millions, probably into the hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars spent on measurement in healthcare. And personally, I question some of the value that we're getting out of that spending. And so I think that question of measurement of what, and maybe more important measurement, why are we measuring something? What are we going to do with that information? How will we use it? How will things ultimately become better is really, really important. To go back where we started, so I have worked on developing measures as well as evaluating and assessing measures across a whole range of different topics, everything from patient safety events in the hospital to understanding access and quality of outpatient care. So, for example, going to a doctor's office or a clinic, to things like care coordination that really span a lot of different situations. It could be from the hospital to the clinic or from one specialist to another, from primary care to a specialist, and gets very difficult to measure. So I've looked at a lot of different aspects of measurement, which I think is really a strength, particularly as I think about what are we missing when we don't talk to patients and family members about what's important to them. What I've learned is we're missing an awful lot.
Let's back up a little bit. In my career as a quality management professional across the continuum of care, one of the things that I would say a lot, and I wasn't very effective at convincing anybody of, was that first was, what do we want to know that we want to improve? And if we measure it, are we going to use it to change it? And if it wasn't something we really wanted to know, and we didn't really have the will to change based on what we learned, it wasn't worth doing it. And in a way, that was a little bit of an easier rap before so much was mandated to be measured. Because then the mandated measure sort of took over. And all the energy was into the mandates rather than we want something to improve. Then, as I got more mature and seasoned and whatever, old, it was, well, if we measure it, are we going to, well, like it was always that people wanted to get an A, you know, they wanted to get 100%, where I had one gig where my boss, the CEO, was really looking for something that we did really bad at. So this was a behavioral health company, and we were measuring outpatient follow-up after inpatient discharge. And we were at something like 12%. I mean, like abominable. And he goes, this is it. It is much easier to go from 12 to 50 than from 80 to 90. And so let's do this one. And at first, in my naivete, I said, no, we suck at this.
That's the point.
And that was what he said. He said, that's the point. You know, right. we could, and then we could feel good that we really, you know, and then we improved it to 50%. Right. And, you know, we could really celebrate.
Right.
Anyway.
I think it's interesting because you just touched on a couple of the things, good, bad, and ugly, about measurement that I found myself really thinking a lot about over the last several years, especially, and I think because I've, you know, really begun to bring patients and caregivers into my own work around measurement and been a strong advocate for that publicly and actually helped other measurement teams be able to do the same. And so one of the things you talked about is, you know, as we measure more and more and as so much of it is mandated, we do lose that connection between the measurement and actually making things better. Right? That mm-hmm. when this measurement enterprise really ramped up in healthcare, it started primarily as quality improvement. And if you go back to that adage I cited, you can't improve what you don't measure, right there, the assumption was the purpose of measurement was improvement. Right? That's where this started. But now measurement has become an assumption that we'll do it. And we've lost some of that connection up to the why and what the purpose of measurement is. And when things are mandated, I think that often happens is, we don't know what the purpose is. It's someone, up the chain on high dictates, this is what we must do, therefore we do it. And it becomes very much a check the box effort or just get it off the to-do list and off it goes and I don't care what happens. And as there have been more and more mandates, that measurement burden has really grown and it has sucked up a lot of the time and energy and resources that may have gone towards quality improvement. Mm-hmm. And it means that the priorities, the things that get measured and that maybe get attention for improvement, because you're right, many people, they want to get the A, and so they put what improvement efforts they have towards the things that are being measured. But it's not necessarily what they might have chosen based on their local context and what they see and what mm-hmm. they hear from their patients and the patients' families, right? The priorities are coming from someone else, whoever is mandating the measurement. And that is many, many different people. So then you end up with all this measurement noise and losing sight of what it's telling you. It's very difficult to pick out the signals amid that noise right now. And so one of the unintended consequences I've really thought about around measurement is the way that it can distract focus, that the emphasis is on the measurement, not what you do with it, and that the attention is focused, again, on the place where you're already measuring things. The last thing anyone in a health system wants to do right now is measure something extra. Mm-hmm. So locally driven efforts at quality improvement, for example, let's look for the thing we're really bad at and let's focus our improvement efforts there. I don't think that that's happening nearly as often as it was even 10 years ago, I would say, because they're so burdened with measuring the things that are mandated, whether it's, by CMS or by their various different commercial insurers with whom they have contracts, mm-hmm. maybe mandated by the state, maybe mandated by the corporate office of the large health system that spans multiple states that, owns that particular clinic. And so you're losing some of the local insight that might have otherwise driven quality improvement efforts that could have included measurement, but also could include other ways of knowing, as I said. When it's the 10th person this week in the waiting room who has mentioned, whether it's a problem with scheduling or frustration with, you know, the wait time in the office, or they're anxious because of something else that's going on, that is another way of knowing. And just because you can't quantify it doesn't mean that it isn't real. And I think a lot of that has gotten lost.
Can you tell us a little bit about what does it mean, patient engagement?
The idea at its base is that we can't do healthcare well without really working with the people we're seeking to serve, because there is no substitute for their perspective. And it's a critical part of the perspective. And so the idea is that we actively listen to patients. We take to heart what they tell us and we act on it. And that can happen at many different levels. That can happen at the point of care. You have a provider who's directly interacting with the patient and asking them, what brings you here today? What concerns you? What do you feel we need to take into consideration, you know, in deciding how to move forward with, you know, whether it's a treatment or diagnosis? But it can also happen at a larger level. If you think of a clinic, you know, if they want to understand what are we doing really well and what are the areas we need to improve on, one of the things you can do is, you know, ask a range of the patients at your clinic about their experience. You can do that through surveys, but I think what distinguishes engagement is really having more of dynamic conversations and ongoing interactions with patients and family members, and really building a relationship that lets you ultimately make things better. We've also seen that work very well in a research context. That's something that PCORI, the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, has done very, very well, is show that, you know, our exploration and analysis of what works and what doesn't work in healthcare also should take into consideration what's important to patients and their families. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we might not be asking the right questions. And my work over the last several years has really focused on extending that approach of patient family engagement and the lessons learned from it into the measurement sphere as well.
So it seems like there's at least two parts to patient engagement. That's the patient who's engaged and what they bring to it, and their lived experience, their business skills, their communication skills, their systems thinking, their culture. So they're bringing, and then there's the other side, which we touched on earlier, which is being able to hear it, not just passively hear it, but hear it and try to understand it deeply, and then translate what you learned into action.
Yes.
Into something. And sometimes, you know, like you and I have talked about the patient engagement part, and more I've been thinking that, well, so much of what happens in healthcare is relationship based, and relationship, like raw relationship, like how we get along and how we communicate, but also the information relationship. And it's a partnership. And so for a while, I would talk about that what I cared about was people at the center of care, patients, clinicians, and the people that support them. Because it's that unit, you know, and some people call that the point of care, whatever you call it. It's that it's about a dynamic relationship, and that having patients engaged over here and clinicians engaged over there without having them engaged together and dealing with their experience, their life flow, their workflow together, it's not as rich.
Right. Absolutely. And so it's interesting you bring up that word relationship, because one of the teams that I and my colleagues doing this work have worked with over the last year and a half, so they are actually a pilot project that we funded under a project supported by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. That team actually really focused on working with caregivers. So caregivers for people who have experienced a severe traumatic brain injury and cannot speak for or advocate for themselves. And so that team brought together caregivers with clinicians and had them think about designing measurement together. And one of the things they've told us is that they really have come to think of this as relationship-centered measurement and relationship-centered work. And they've really pushed us.
Oh,
they've
so
really
exciting.
Pushed us to rethink our language around patient-centered. And I have really learned to emphasize patient and caregiver or patient and family centered. But they've said, you know, there's something deeper here that really is about a relationship of the people who are receiving care, the people in their life who are supporting them on that journey, and the people who are providing the care and supporting. And there is something magic that happens when that comes together in an ongoing relationship where it isn't something transactional. And
okay, so that's like wonderful, but it seems so not scalable.
Yes, I think, well, you know, our current system has moved more and more towards sort of, you know, assembly line. It's trying to be systematic and efficient and cut out waste and, you know, trying to do things in a very standardized way also. And I think the trade-off, some of what you lose, are the places where you adapt to the particular situation and the particular people, and you create space for building relationships. And you know, but to do that isn't always scalable. It's going to look really different for this family than for that family. And it's going to look really different in this clinic than that clinic. It might even look different, you know, from 10 o'clock to 10:30 if you're a provider, as you go, you know, mm-hmm. from one visit or interaction to another. Mm-hmm. And that's messy.
Well, and our research methodology is not friendly with that.
No, and you want to
do research on something that you can manualize, something that you can create a manual for. Whereas if 10 to 10:30 is, you know, in on the south side of Chicago is different from, you know, noon to 1 o'clock in Spokane, that's the messiness.
It's messy, right? And I think we, you know, there's a strong tendency to try and cut out the messiness, this strong tendency to try and standardize and make things systematic and, as I said, really streamline. And there certainly are some advantages to trying to be more efficient. We spend a lot of money on healthcare in this country. We've got to figure out how to get more for that money. And we've got to figure out how to slow down the increase in how much we spend on healthcare.
Yeah, but it's not going to come from efficiency.
But I
that's not where the money is.
I definitely have questions about the route we're trying to take towards that. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I've found myself thinking about it increasingly is, you know, if you walk into a clinic and you're greeted by the receptionist and they check you in, and then you go back and you have a medical assistant and they take your, you know, temperature and your blood pressure, and then you see the provider. And there may be, you know, a couple other people you interact with along the way. Behind every one of those actual people you directly interact with, there must be 10, maybe today 20 people you don't see, who are negotiating the health insurance contracts, who are reporting the measures, who are managing the money, who are
managing the IT systems
and scheduling the people, managing the IT systems. Yeah. And if you go up another layer, you know, then it's the people you know, within at a state level, the people at a corporate level, the people at a federal level who are overseeing all of this. And then there are, yes, people like me who, you know, come at it from another angle of trying to improve things, trying to understand and study, trying to provide recommendations. But we also add costs to the healthcare system. I definitely recognize that. I've gone to a place of embracing some of the messy interpersonal relationship-based kind of approaches. Like, let's try that for a little while and see what we learn there. And hopefully we find a middle ground somewhere, some way soon.
So what do you think over the last year, if you could, if you wanted to trumpet two things you've learned that are really exciting, what would they be?
So one of the things, you know, just recently in December, I was preparing for a talk and, you know, really struggling to say, pull out of myself some of what I've learned, and finally hit on an insight that the patient and family engagement, in particular, the partnership with patients, whether it's around measurement, I think this also would apply to research or quality improvement or care delivery. I think part of the magic formula for that is a combination of really being committed to wanting to listen and understand and act on what you hear from patients. So commitment to that idea of patient-centeredness, as well as flexibility. Because chances are what you hear is not going to be what you expected. And that is the point. If you always heard what you expected, we wouldn't need that extra step, right?
Right, right, right.
But the value is when you hear something you didn't expect, when you learn something you didn't know, and then you have to be able to act on that. And that requires flexibility. You have to pivot, right? I mean, going back to your story, Danny, you know, it was like, well, you thought, why do we want to focus on that? We're really bad at that. Well, that was the whole point. You had to kind of pivot. And so it's really that combination of a willingness to be flexible and a commitment to act on what you hear from patients and caregivers, I think, that opens the door to a lot of progress and a lot of value.
Now a word about our sponsor, Abridge. Use Bridge to record the Zen. Push the big pink button and record the conversation with your doctor or therapist. Read the transcript or listen to clips when you get home. Check out the app at abridge.com, ABRIDGE.com, or download it on the Apple App Store or Google Play Store. Record your healthcare conversations. Let me know how it went. Another thing that I've been focusing on lately is this idea of sustainability. That I think that so much of what we measure and what we learn is we learn in very specific settings and circumstances. And that, you know, medicine is famous for, I don't know the statistics, I probably have them somewhat wrong, but it takes 17 years for some new guideline to be implemented across the industry, which then I think, well, by then the science has changed.
The science has changed.
But there's something about, well, first of all, what makes a difference is usually things that are common sense and relatively simple. But we have such a behemoth system. We have such behemoth systems that it's very hard to change any of it. And so when research or measurement is done and something is identified as having a positive effect on whatever setting or circumstance, that it doesn't lead to sustained change. And sometimes I wonder, because I think discovery is really different than maintenance. You know, like it's a whole different energy and focus. So to change, like to change inertia for in a better direction, just like it's really hard for individuals to change their habits, it's hard for organizations to change theirs. But I don't know that we do measurement about how sustainable something is. I don't know that I'm saying this right. Do you understand what I'm...
Yeah, yeah. So it's interesting. I think there's sustainability, right? So you put something new into place, and does it last, or is it just the flavor of the month? Then there's also a question of consistency, and which is a little different, but I think similar. So consistency,
okay, say different.
Consistency, you know, if you're thinking of, you know, okay, we have evidence that this checklist improves, you know, patient safety outcomes for hospital stay, right? Consistency would be it's used across, you know, all departments of the hospital, and it's used in this hospital and that hospital and that hospital, right? So it's to some degree about the spread.
Okay.
And whereas sustainability is in any one of those hospitals, or even just, you know, a particular division within the hospital, once they've started using it, they keep using it over time. And I think, you know, they're related because some of what you're pointing to as challenge is the level of energy around it. And I think just a sense of being overwhelmed by these many different systems and all the things that our care providers are supposed to be doing. I mean, there's so much that we're expecting of them right now. It's hard to make sense of all of it. I think that relates to both and creates challenges both in sustainability and consistency. But I also feel like there's some value to tease those apart a little bit.
Okay.
So measurement has focused a lot on consistency, right?
Okay.
That we look across hospitals or across providers or across patient populations or situations, and we look across time and we're saying, what is the rate of this? How often are people using this checklist that we've told them is an important checklist? Mm-hmm. And we measure that really well. I don't know that we measure sustainability very well. Like, mm-hmm. you know, once you've implemented it, are they still using it? You know, that means tracking over time in one place. And then caring if what you see is that it's dropping off. And I think that's where that measurement noise comes into play, that, you know, people focus on getting their rate to a certain level because they're being measured on it and they want that, you know, they want to get a good grade. And then the next thing comes up they have to focus on, and the first thing can fall by the wayside or backslide. And I think it gets lost along the way.
Well, you know, in this day and age, we can take the example of hand washing, which is sort of no-brainer. Do you really need to do the science anymore, how important hand washing is? But I remember 35, 40 years ago in my first management job was as an ICU manager. And we were looking at our hand washing. And what we realized is that if we really washed our hands as long as we were supposed to wash our hands, it would take, I'm making this up because I don't remember, like a half an hour of the day of an 8-hour shift.
Wow.
You know, something like, I'm an exaggerator, so I might be exaggerating, but it was a chunk. And so there's the there's the spread. What did you just call that?
Consistency.
The consistency. So there's the consistency, which is really hard to do because you're in and out of rooms and, you know, there's always this movement. And so there's just so much hand washing. Then there's the, okay, well, we did all this work and now everybody's remembering and we're doing it, but, you know, then it tails off.
Right.
Right. And that is like something that's really simple.
Right.
No, that, and it's tried and true.
Right. I mean, I personally, I wonder how much some of that, you know, tailing off, like we lose it over time, is because we're constantly trying to improve things and you get improvement fatigue. And I've definitely heard conversations about that and recognizing that. And it becomes demoralizing to always think, you know, just when we've accomplished one thing, now we're told we're not good enough on something else. At the same time, then there are a lot of conversations going on within healthcare right now about being a continuous improvement mindset or culture or approach. Mm-hmm. The idea that just having people accept we will always have to be making improvements. We should always be striving to be better. We should be growing and trying to reframe that a little bit. And I'm sure some places have been far more successful in that culture change than others. But I mean, again, that's where you start getting into the messy interpersonal relationships, the organizational mm-hmm. culture, the leadership climate that makes some places be very successful. They can have sustained, consistent change. They have energy and excitement around continuous improvement, and other places where it feels like a slog. And I challenge, you know, any MBA consultant, you know, management guru with a lot of numbers to figure out like what makes a difference where it's a slog and where it's exciting. I think it comes down to the organizational culture and a lot of interpersonal people relationships, and it's messy, but it's really important.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because I think that's what I was going to ask you is, like, certainly I've been VP and director of quality in many organizations, and there's certainly a difference in the cultures and in the embrace of measurement, quality, change, improvement. And I would say, the first thing is the boss. My first C-suite job was in managed care. And my boss, I was a VP for quality or director of quality. And my boss was the executive director. And he, you know, at the 3 month, you know, he did what bosses should do, which is tell me, what do you think? You've been here, you know, this short amount of time. What are your observations for me? And I said, well, I don't think we're moving along at the speed you want to move at. And he said, well, what do you recommend? And I said, frankly, we have to start with you. And then I thought, oh my God, what did I just say? You know, I was like, oh my, this is a career ending thing to say. And he was said, okay, every morning I'm in town, I will come in a half hour early and it's your agenda. And we'll do it as long as we need to. Well, oh my God. You know, then it was like, what am I going to do with this? You know, but we ended up, you know, it was the first time, you know, we had, you know, a member advisory panel. We had a provider advisory panel. We, you know, had a well-rounded dashboard of how we kept our fingers on the pulse of the organization. It led to some amazing things. They really cut back on pre-authorizations. It was where this, you know, the rate of, you know, he was the one that said, well, where do we really suck? And let's look there. And But, you know, that was partially that he was such a strong leader and he wasn't intimidated, and he was competitive in the sense that he wanted things to be better, not that he was the best. And he hired people who would implement that, who would hire staff who were open to it.
Yeah.
So that's not, I don't know that in, you know, the rest of my 40-some career, I had seen anything quite like it. So it's not that generalizable.
Yeah. Well, and he was able to mobilize your energy around that, right? I mean, yeah. He put the onus on you. Like, you have 30 minutes a day.
That's a lot of time.
That's a lot of time.
That was like 4 days a week. I had to be prepared.
Yeah, right? Yeah. But he did it in a way that, you know, to you, sounds like was exciting, but also a responsibility. It was an a career opportunity. Mm-hmm. So you brought your A game. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's some of the magic. Right. And so, I don't know, the more I learn, the more I feel like this work comes down to interpersonal relationships and interpersonal skills, and a culture of how we lead and how we listen. And it comes down to power dynamics. Mm-hmm. And again, those things are messy and they're difficult to quantify. Instead of trying to quantify everything, I feel like there's value in let's develop more of those skills.
What do you recommend to organizations that are, they haven't been on the patient engagement bandwagon, and maybe they're just hearing it for the first time, which is sort of hard to believe, but hey, what do you think are success factors that you would share with those people, organizations?
I would say, you know, find someone who is a really good listener, who brings energy to bring together a group of patients, family members, or, you know, it might be members, it might be community members, depending on the situation, to bring them together and ask some very open-ended questions. What's important to you in your life? What could we do better to support you? What haven't we asked that you think is important? Some simple questions like that, and to just really listen and give that person who's bringing them together the leeway to do what they think is best about bringing the group together, and give them the opportunities to share what they hear up and down the organization. Don't only report it in the C-suite, but the C-suite should hear what they've learned. Also share it, you know, the frontline personnel, maybe they're scheduling or they're answering the phone or they're, you know, they're taking complaints or questions from people in a call center, and make it be a conversation, not just one-way sharing. Like, here's what we're hearing. What are you hearing? Get people across the organization engaged in a dialogue, and then be ready as an organization to put some resources towards addressing, you know, the three things, or maybe you have to start with just the one thing that keeps bubbling up that you're hearing not only from your patients, members, community, but you're also hearing from some of the members of your own organization. Many of them will be able to put their finger on that pain point. Mm-hmm. And as you think about how to address that, again, bring together all the different people who are touched by it. If it's about a scheduling frontline thing, make sure you have several people that do that scheduling in the room, and their manager, and some of the patients or members who, you know, who have to interact around that process. And again, keep an open mind about what's possible, about what you're already doing. You have to check the egos at the door and really want to make it better. And then celebrate those early wins. And I think that can get the ball going, you know, even starting little.
And so what you're sort of describing is like exercise the muscle. It's weak, so exercise it. And then it'll get stronger as you use it.
Right. Okay. And I think so you asked me earlier, I think you asked for two of my recent lessons learned, and I shared one. So here's another one to this point, which is that this is a skill set. None of us is born knowing how to do this. We don't get trained in it in most of our, you know, education and degree program. We don't even get on the job training of it most of the time. Some people have the opportunity to develop these skills, and some of us, it gets developed out of us. And so no one should feel bad for coming in and finding it hard to be an active listener or to be flexible, to pivot, to engage in some of this messy relationship. But we all should be willing to grow that muscle and to exercise it. And if we come in with that mindset, like don't beat yourself up, but be willing to grow, it goes a long way in this work.
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you. This has been fun. I always love talking with you.
Yeah, likewise. A Zen conversation. How can we do better with what's vital in our local healthcare system? What can we commit to improving? Commitment is will, resources, and time. Then measure relevant outcomes and processes. The measurement can't take more effort than improvement. The key to such improvement is the engagement of people at the center. That's patients, clinicians, and the people that support them. Focus on those relationships. Measure consistency and sustainability. As in any health effort, exercise weak muscles. Thank you, Ellen Schultz. It's been a hoot. See the show notes, previous podcasts, and other resources on my website, www.health-hats.com/pod. Please subscribe or contribute. If you like it, share it. Thanks. See you around the block.